Chango.
Think about things that are difficult to do. Like if you made a list of things that are hard to do, being a parent would be close to or at the top of that list, right? Especially of a baby, you know, like a screaming, mewling, drooling, not sleeping when you want it to sleep, little, totally dependent baby. Man, forget it. Too much for me. Anyway, I think most of us would agree that's a really difficult thing to do for two parents, you know, which is as good as it gets, I guess, in Western culture. But it's way too much for two parents, and certainly way too much for one parent. But people do it. Now, take other things from that list. Another thing that would be on the list would be hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, right? From Canada all the way down to Southern California. Now, put those two things together, and you've got today's guest. Jack McClure just wrote a book, or just published a book, just came out yesterday. It's called You Carry the Tent, I'll Carry the Baby. And it's the story of Jack and his wife Elena and their little baby hiking the fucking Pacific Crest Trail from Canada to Mexico. Their daughter was 9 months old, I think, when they left. 1,500 miles with a baby. I don't know. I don't know. Some people, the things people do. I mean, come on now. Anyway, I got an email from Jack a few weeks ago. You know, one of these emails, hey, I listen to your podcast and I did this thing and I don't know if you'd be willing to talk about it, have me on your podcast. And I had him send me a PDF of the book and I thought, well, look, I'll read a little bit of it, and if it's competently written, you know, because the thing is, I'm caught between opposing agendas here, right? Like, I want to help him out, and I'm interested in talking to someone who's done something like this, but I don't want to encourage you, listener, to waste your time on a shitty book or a shitty piece of music or whatever. I'm trying to respect your time as well. And so I thought, well, if the book is well written, you know, maybe I'll talk to him or I'll just recommend the book or I'll discuss the book or whatever. Anyway, I started reading it and I thought I'll read 50 pages or whatever. I read the whole damn book. I didn't want to stop. It's really well written. It's amazing that Jack has never written before because at least never written a book before, because this is very well written. The story moves along. It's very he manages to find that sweet spot between oversharing and not sharing enough, you know, and giving you the feeling that you're getting some sort of sanitized version of things. As we talk about in this conversation you're about to hear, Jack and his wife Elena had some issues. That's no surprise to anyone, I'm sure. You know, any kind of travel brings up issues in a relationship, because of the stress, because of the lack of sleep. You're not in your own bed. You know, the lack of routine, all that kind of stuff heightens whatever pre-existing stressors there are. But these guys really like took it to the limit. I mean, This isn't just, you know, a couple of weeks on a beach in Mexico. This is let's go walk from Canada to Southern California with our baby and sleep in tents along the way and deal with bugs and all the crazy stuff that happens, you know, food that isn't where it's supposed to be when you get there to pick it up and, you know, you forgot the diaper soap and the bee stings and the, I mean, it's just all kinds of stuff comes up that you can't possibly predict. And, you know, and so any pre-existing cracks in the foundation of the relationship are going to be accentuated for sure. So that's part of the story. And it took some real courage for Jack to include that and for Elena to be cool with it. And so there's, you know, a story within the story, as these things always happen. Anyway, it's called You Carry the Tent, I'll Carry the Baby. And Jack McClure is my guest today. I'm really looking forward to bringing this one to you. And I'm going to leave it at that. I will save my yammering for another podcast or maybe another Roma. I appreciate all of you out there. The Budokan retreat, Sexaton retreat, is, I think, all booked up. We have more people who have registered than we have spots available, but not everyone who has registered has paid a deposit. So at this point we're sending out emails and stuff. So there, if you're interested and you've just been kind of slow on the draw, register right away as soon as you hear this from me, and you'll be included if some of these people who've already registered have changed plans and aren't going to send in a deposit, then those spots will open up. So if you're interested in going to this thing in Whitefish, Montana in June, please register right away, and then we'll figure it out. But I think we're pretty much booked up on paper anyway. All right, I'm going to play you a tune by Dante Cimadamore. Cimadamore, I think so. He listens to the podcast, and he sent me some of his music, and he said, it's on Spotify, but there's no record labels or copyright issues, so I don't think you'll have a problem. We'll see. I'm going to play it for you. It's about falling in love at Burning Man and finding your passion once again. The song is called A Way Back Home, which seemed like appropriate to this particular podcast. And the band is called Give Me Motion, which is also appropriate to this particular podcast episode. All right. If you enjoy this, I hope you'll pick up a copy of the book, You Carry the Tent, I'll Carry the Baby. And enjoy it. Thanks for listening, everybody. Hope things are going well where you are. All right, Jack, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I read you sent me a PDF of your book, and I thought I'll just take a quick look and kind of, you know, scan a little bit and get a sense of it. And I ended up sitting here for about 3 hours or whatever it took to read it. I read the whole thing in one sitting. It's really good. It's really good.
Thank you.
You carry the tent, I'll carry the baby. One family's journey on the Pacific Crest Trail. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. I remember I sent you the email, and then I went to bed and I checked it later, and it was like an hour later, and you're like, I'm already most of the way through the book. I was like, whoa, all right.
Yeah. It's good. I mean, it's not a difficult read. It's, you know, you're talking about what's happening on the trail, and it moves along at a nice pace. And, I gotta tell you, I think one of the things I appreciated the most about it was how, vulnerable you are in the book about the journey that was happening in your marriage at the same time that you guys were hiking the trail. If you hadn't done that, I think it would have come across as just another look at me, I did something, you know, unusual kind of story, which isn't really that interesting to me anyway. But the fact that there was a lot of self-reflection, you know, you talked about some of your own psychological habits, and you know, your wife, is it Elena or Alana, how do you pronounce it?
Alana, yep,
Alana. Like, when she calls you out on shit, you quote her accurately, I assume.
Right.
And you know, that to me, that really made it a much more interesting read, because you know, the internal journey was as interesting as the external journey.
Yeah, I tried to capture that, because that was, like you said, I mean, we carried a baby on the Pacific Crest Trail. That's, you know, unique in itself, but otherwise for most people, if you're not really into backpacking or hiking, it's like, oh, that's kind of neat. But you know, like you said, you might not be as interested in it. But yeah, I guess through that experience, us hiking on the trail, a large part of our difficulty was not, I guess it was a result of going with our daughter, but the consequence of taking a baby along is it just took out any buffer of physically and emotionally, and then, yeah, any weaknesses in the relationships, primarily between me and Alana, got exposed, and that became one of the biggest challenges on the trip and something we had to contend with almost every day.
Yeah, at one point, I may be mixing this up, but I think at one point in the book you talk about how, you know, a lot of people were sort of criticizing the idea of taking a baby on the trail, and you were like, well, isn't this what our hunter-gatherer ancestors did? You know, they walked long
right.
distances, and they carried their kids, and I wanted to say, no, dude, no, our hunter-gatherer ancestors had a whole community. It
that's
wasn't
true.
Mom,
yeah.
Dad, and baby out there, you know, and that's
right.
such a burden on parents. And I feel like so many parents think, well, that's the way it's always been. Why am I freaked out? Why am I overwhelmed? You know, and they feel inadequate, but they shouldn't, because that's not the way it was. You know, there were grandparents and cousins and, you know, adolescent kids who would carry the baby and help out. So you guys had a lot more of that kind of stress than our ancestors.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, in a certain sense, we're mimicking what they're doing, and that we're outside. We're not hunting, obviously, or we weren't sourcing any of our materials necessarily from the surrounding environment. But yeah, we're living and traveling outside day after day. But yeah, like you said, you know, that falls all on us. So if there's a night we don't have any sleep or we need extra help, we're the ones that suffer for that. And yeah, having kids really teaches you that. I mean, you know, more than most, you wrote one of your books about it, but that community is such a massive part that's missing in our culture, and a lot of the burden, unfortunately, is placed on women, who have to pick up a lot of the slack. And you know, I work from home most of the time when we're not on the trail and doing whatever. So I'm able to, you know, get a sense, more of a sense, and play a larger role in that sense in helping out. And you kind of get to witness what it would be like just having one parent around, and that's just at home. And it's incredibly difficult and it's incredible emotional strain. And yeah, we're, you know, we might be an advanced society, but there's still parts that are incredibly lacking, and community is an obvious one in that sense.
Yeah, there was a period in the book where you were hanging out. Was the guy's name Adam, I think?
Adam, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember you commenting on how nice it was to have someone kind of around in addition to the two of you who wasn't freaked out by the baby and was kind of a chill dude, and just how much of a help that was.
Right.
You know, which really, imagine if there had been, you know, seven or eight Adams and seven or eight, you know, women and some kids, and it would have been a whole different thing, you know, just moving down that trail as 20 or 30 people taking care of each right. other.
And I guess in a sense that does kind of happen with some people on the trail. They, you know, it's rare for families to be on the trail. I think there was one other family while we were out there, but it's not rare for there to be tramilies, is what people call them. They're trail families, essentially. And, you know, people who end up hiking together, similar distances, kind of getting grouped together after the start. And so, yeah, there are big groups of people. They don't have kids, but they are hiking with, they form these little communities for months at a time. And yeah, that's a totally different experience than, you know, going by yourself or even just with your own family. And it would be, yeah, in many ways, you know, I think there's some aspects of, you know, especially as Americans, the individual lifestyle that we come to enjoy, and you know, having our own privacy sometimes, and, you know, being able to go off and do something by yourself and not necessarily experiencing some of the frictions that come with community living. But at the same time, you know, you miss out on a ton of benefits of having other people around. A lot of those psychological and end up leading to issues, you know, like anxiety and loneliness that are kind of endemic in our culture.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Did you know when you guys were having this experience, were you already planning to write a book about it, or did that idea come afterwards?
I'd thought about it during, somebody had suggested it, and that it might be an interesting idea, especially with our background and living in Alaska and, you know, going to, the lower 48 and experiencing the wilderness environment there, where it's, you know, it's slightly different and, than what we were accustomed to. But I didn't really settle on it until after we were done.
Well, I got to tell you, it's very well written.
Thank you.
It's impressive. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're good. I don't know how much help you got from editors and so on, but the final product is a good read.
Thank you. So, I appreciate that.
That's not easy. So where do you live in Alaska?
Fairbanks, Alaska, basically the center of the state.
You're in Fairbanks, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did some time in Fairbanks Correctional Center. Don't know
did
if
you
it's
really?
Still there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's still there. Yeah, what'd you go in for?
Yeah. Shoplifting.
Okay.
Yeah. It's still on my record. The FBI has informed me. I went in to get a global entry pass, you know, so I could sort of skip immigration when I fly internationally and have to go in for an interview. And the guy's like, you know, he's like, hey, you said you've never been convicted of a crime. And I said, yeah, I haven't. And he said, Fairbanks, Alaska, 1983. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? That's still on my record. He's like, yep. I was like, oh, shit.
That's funny.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, yeah, I was.
No, it's still there. I had a friend a few years ago who, he was in college and at University of Alaska Fairbanks, and they had, I think it was a criminal justice course or a psychology course or something like that. And they had, they went to go tour the correctional facility. It was kind of like a scared straight type of deal. And he came out, you know, I don't know what it was like when you were there, but he swore that he's never stepping foot in that building again.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No,
he was
it
just
was
kind
great
of terrified
by
it. Oh, really? Okay.
Well, I mean, this, I've told this story on the podcast before, but basically I hitchhiked up from, I guess, Skagway that year, up through the, you know, Yukon and then across through Tok. And when we got to Fairbanks, we had been like hanging. I met these two dudes on the trail, and we'd been living in the woods for, I don't know, a week or 2 weeks and before we got a ride. And so we went to the grocery store. It's a long story, but I've shared it on the podcast before. But anyway, I ended up eating a Snickers bar that I didn't pay for, and we got busted, and the cop was an asshole, and I had some weed in my pocket, which was legal, but made him, you know, dislike me more. And, you know, we were a couple of, you know, smart ass college boys from outside coming up to Alaska for the summer. And he decided to teach us a lesson. So it was Memorial Day weekend, and it was like late Thursday afternoon. And he took us to fucking Fairbanks Correctional Center. And we were there till Tuesday when court opened again. Yeah, me and my buddy. And yeah, and we were like, we were doing our laundry across the street from the grocery store, and our third friend stayed there with our laundry, and he and I went over to the grocery store to use a payphone. This is before, you know, cell phones and all that. And yeah, so we were wearing, we were washing all our clothes. So we show up in prison wearing shorts with no underwear and like a jacket with no shirt. And I remember after we got booked or whatever, when your intake, we're walking by all these dudes like in their cells, and they're like, "Yo, you boys coming from the beach? What's going on?" And we're like two 19-year-old,
right? Yeah,
fucking out of place. Scared shitless. But no, it was okay. Back in the day, this was in '83, Memorial Day, 1983 weekend, and no, it was like because of all the oil money up there, they had all you can eat meals and
that's great.
Salad bar, and it was like, and luckily the dude who did the intake on us, he put us on cots in the gym, and he said, "I'm not gonna, you guys are gonna sleep alone in the gym, just the two of you, and but during the day you're gonna be with the general population, so you stick together and watch each other's backs, and you'll get through this okay." And we did. It was great. So, well, I'm glad to hear it's still there. I still remember lying on my cot, looking up at the wall. I was, you know, in the basketball court, and it said, "Home of the FCC Eagles." Like, okay, my alma mater.
Yeah, exactly. You're a proud alumni.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we got Tuesday, we go in, and we were sentenced to time served plus 20 hours community service, which was cleaning out the basement of the Council of the Midnight Sun Boy Scout Troop headquarters.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so you've been in Alaska a while. You did a Knowles course up there. Is that?
Yep. I did a Knowles course in 2013. I was still going to college at that time, and I had one more year left after that. And but yeah, the Knowles course, spent 75 days out in Alaska backpacking, glacier mountaineering, and sea kayaking, and that's really what got me hooked. I didn't really have any experience doing outdoor trips growing up with my family. I just grew up in the Chicago suburbs, and they weren't really into that type of thing. And that was kind of my gateway and window to the outdoors and living in Alaska.
So what is it specifically about Alaska? Like, why did you pick Alaska rather than, you know, Washington or Wyoming or someplace?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I didn't have any conception of Alaska. I don't know if you did prior to your trip up, but a lot of people, when they think of Alaska, you know, you think it's just people living in igloos and there's snow all the time and whatever up there. And so, I mean, I didn't know anything really about Alaska besides, you know, what I maybe saw on some TV shows before going up. I 6 months before I went on that course, and what kind of jump-started the whole thing is I came across these journals about this guy named Dick Prenicke. He's kind of a renowned Alaskan who's dead now, but he was in the 1960s at the age of 50. He went out into a remote area in what's now Lake Clark National Park and built a small log cabin by hand, completely with hand tools, with materials he brought in. He fashioned handles for everything once he got out there, and it's really well done. But that's not really, well, that's part of why he's noteworthy, but also then he lived there off and on for the better part of 30 years, documenting the animals and the surrounding area, you know, living isolated 50, 60 miles off the road from the nearest town. And I read one of his journals, just the journals of Richard Prenicke or Dick Prenicke. It's, you can find it easily on Amazon. There's documentaries as well. And I was hooked. I was like, that's what I wanted to do. Like I mentioned, I was in school at that time, and, you know, I was kind of dissatisfied with the idea of following what my peers were doing. I was in business school, and my mom's an accountant, my dad works in finance, and, you know, the path presented to me was going forward and working in corporate culture, and that just seemed so boring, you know, going to an office all day and living in the suburbs to come home and watch TV and, you know, do the same thing for 40 years. And I read that book and I was like, I want to do that. And my mom's like, oh yeah, that's cool, but you don't have any skills. And I was like, okay, yeah, good point.
Thanks, Mom.
Thanks, Mom. Yeah, reality check. And so by chance, I came across the Knowles website. I didn't know about them earlier, like 2 weeks later. And I was like, oh, that's how I start. And so I did the Knowles course, and that was transformative in the sense, you know, of being in a place like that where we were out for 50 days at a time during one portion of it in Wrangell St. Elias National Park. We didn't come across any towns. We didn't come across any people other than our resupply pilot and a state trooper once. And it's just, you know, there are what, like 12, 13 of us. So we did have that community, kind of like you were talking about earlier. And I kind of found a sense of inner peace with that in being in these wide, open and vast lands where it's just us and the things we have on our back and the animals. And it just was life at, it was life at its core, or maybe not at its core, but life, it was a simplified life in that we had everything we needed. We didn't talk to anybody else. You know, there was a sat phone, but just the instructors used it. So everything we needed was right there. We were in the present moment, and that just hooked me, and I wanted more of that.
Yeah. For people who don't know what we're talking about, Knowles is National Outdoor Leadership School. And they've been running these backcountry wilderness education courses for, God, I don't know, 50 years maybe?
Yeah, I think they started in the early 1970s.
Yeah. Yeah, I looked into Knowles when I was a young lad. Are they still teaching? I remember they were teaching like some special way to walk. There was like they had invented their proprietary stride or something.
I think I know what you're talking about. They send you a book before you go out. It's like their expedition field guide. And, you know, it talks about gear and, you know, miscellaneous things about backpacking and walking. But then one of them is walking styles. And the only one I remember, which is probably what you're referring to, it's like a half step. It's you're walking normally, but as you're picking up, you know, your foot that's up in the air, you're pausing just for half a second, and apparently it's, you know, some type of micro rest that you can just keep going. I asked my instructors about it when we were out there. They had no idea what I was talking about.
So, really? Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's just, you know, a relic of the past. I don't know if it caught on.
Yeah. I at the time I remember thinking, you know, that's kind of, I don't know, kind of ballsy to claim you've come up with a new way of walking. People have been doing this for a while, you know. I figure that's something I don't need to be taught, you know, how to walk.
Right, exactly.
But but yeah, it did. I remember the Outward Bound and Knowles were kind of like the two big options. And my impression, this is, you know, what, I'm 60, so this is 40 years ago. But the impression I had was that Knowles was like very serious and, you know, more kind of like, hardcore than Outward Bound was.
Yeah. I don't know too much about Outward Bound, but they do take it seriously. I mean, I got a full semester's worth of college credit for it. which is kind of silly to think about. And but yeah, they place a big focus on teaching leadership skills and through the natural environment, and so dealing with the elements and kind of using that as a way to foster growth in individuals and as a group.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It sounds fantastic. So back to your trip, would you say, well, let me just ask you open-ended, what, when you think of challenges and, you know, moments where you were ready to throw it in and just call it off, I'm guessing it's the bee sting, but were there, is that what comes to mind, or were there other moments that were more challenging?
You know, surprisingly, the bee sting, at least the major one, I don't think either of us necessarily thought about quitting after that, even though it was probably one of the most, I don't know if traumatic's the right word, but not, I mean, maybe, yeah, it's the most, one of the most emotional experiences of the trip. Yeah, I guess
just fill people in about what happened there.
Sure. So my wife Alana is deathly allergic to all kinds of stinging insects, bees, wasps, yellow jackets, basically anything in that category. And we knew that going into the trip, she'd had experiences in the past where she had to be evacuated from the backcountry within Alaska. And so we brought along an EpiPen, and she got stung once in southern Washington when we were hiking, and she experienced some swelling, but we were able to take some medicine and nothing happened. While we were in central Oregon, we were hiking separately briefly, and she ended up getting stung again. And it took a few minutes before I was able to get back to her, and both of us reunited. And in that time span, she had broken out in hives across most of her upper torso. And we were trying to figure things out about where to go, because we were still a few miles from the road and there was a lake resort nearby. And then she went unconscious and passed out from anaphylactic shock. And so I gave her an EpiPen and basically was dealing with my, you know, semi-conscious wife. She was going in and out of consciousness while also dealing with our daughter at the time, who needed, you know, a diaper change and to be fed, and, you know, didn't understand what was going on. So essentially having two patients.
your daughter must have just been panicking as well, like seeing right. my mom and seeing how stressed you were, and like, uh-oh, like, I don't know. How old was she at the time?
At the time, I imagine like 10 months old. Yeah. yeah.
So that's old enough to know shit's not right. You know?
Right. Right. Yeah. She could probably pick up on that and get a sense of that. And yeah, you know, I had one EpiPen, and that's what I ended up giving to her, to give epinephrine, and we had some antihistamines. But other than that, it was pretty much left up to fate. You know, it was praying that, you know, she'd come back and, from being unconscious, and that the symptoms would decrease and we wouldn't need any more EpiPens, or that emergency response would arrive in time. That was kind of, well, I guess we had no way of knowing before that, but, you know, emergency response did end up coming, but they came from a town that was over an hour and a half away. So if something did happen, they wouldn't have helped out. Yeah. Thankfully it turned out for the best. And yeah, that was only halfway into our trip. So we continued after that. And your question was about the moment where
Yeah, like the most challenging moments or moments that really pushed you to your limit.
Yeah, I think that may have been one of them. But I mean, we still opted to continue on. We decided that if, you know, she got stung again, we'd get off the trail. She did end up getting stung again. We continued with the trail. and I think probably the difficulties between us and our marriage, that was the most difficult, because they were long stemming issues. And I kind of touch on this in the book a little bit, you know, stuff that had occurred in our relationship from the start, and just being on the trail only amplified it. And so we're doing these long days, you know, hiking 20 miles at a time, And then not really sleeping at night. Our daughter wasn't really a good sleeper at the time, so we're not able to get much rest. And then dealing with both of those challenges while dealing with our relationship and not necessarily getting a break from each other, that kind of stressed things in the sense that even though we came to the point where we knew what was happening and, you know, what was triggering each other, it wasn't necessarily, you know, it's like changing characteristics and longstanding habits. It's not something that necessarily happens overnight. And that was the most difficult, I think, in the sense of wondering not only if we leave the, each time we were wondering, like debating whether to leave the trail, it was often with, one of us, mainly, you know, Alana being fed up and wanting to not only leave the trail, but leave myself and separate ourselves. And so I think just because of that sense, not necessarily because we're leaving the trail, but because of this, the greater implications beyond it, those were probably the most stressful moments.
How does she feel about the book, and particularly the, you know, the sort of vulnerability and you know, making public these private struggles that you were going through?
She didn't like the early editions, I'll tell you that. It took a lot of reworking. And that, you know, I guess I tried to make it come across because, you know, I am the author of the book and the one that wrote it. It's going to be my perspective. I tried to capture it, you know, as neutrally as possible, but it's going to be, you know, biased from my perspective. She's read the book, you know, more than anybody besides myself. And, she's comfortable with where it's at now. And, you know, she wouldn't change anything. But yeah, I guess we see part of the reason we're willing to share our vulnerability with others is that, with the idea of our trip and what we experienced on the trail, we were able to inspire so many other people. And I think if we just omitted that part, like we were talking about earlier, there might be backpackers and hikers who take some inspiration from that trip, but they're not going to necessarily appreciate all that went into it. And that, yeah, it's not just roses and, you know, hiking up mountains and looking out on Grand Peaks the whole time. There's some struggle that goes along with it. I talk about in the book how we came to these discussions and how we ended up resolving a lot of our differences. And the book ended up helping, writing the book ended up helping a lot in that sense as well. And that we were able to, you know, continue to further flesh out what we thought happened, the other person's perspective and better understand each other. So I think we're, you know, both content with the final project or the final output.
Right. That's interesting. So, yeah. So there was the trip itself, and then there was the journey of writing the book about the trip. So sort of
right.
Reanalyzing it and talking about what really happened that day. Yeah.
Right. Because, yeah, I guess when I was saying earlier that, you know, she didn't like the early versions of the book is because I think in some sense, both of us still felt somewhat slighted from our interactions on the trip. And my early drafts of the book were more so, you know, in my direction and kind of omitting her as just making her like some type of side character. And this is, you know, me being all great without me doing any real analysis on how I contributed to our issues and to the problems. And so from that point, you know, we had lots of conversations and talks and basically being able to come to an understanding of what actually happened. And then, yeah, realizing that a lot of what happened was ultimately, you know, my fault and things that I contributed to. And I tried to make that, to have that come across in the book and tried to portray have a more balanced portrayal of Alana and, you know, what she brought to the table accurate representation of our relationship.
Yeah, which is really difficult to do if she's not speaking for herself, right? Like,
exactly.
It's very hard to sort of represent someone else's perspective fairly because you don't really know their perspective, you know? It came across, to me anyway, it came across as quite fair, and, you know, definitely didn't come across as like she was, you know, like brittle or impatient or whatever. Mm-hmm. She just got fed up sometimes, as anyone would, right. You know, it's structural. You guys are on the trail. You're not sleeping. You got the baby. You got, you know, you're trying not to bother the other hikers, you know, but the baby doesn't want to sleep or wants to sleep now. Or, you know, it's just like you guys were dealing with a lot of shit coming at you.
Yeah.
Literal shit as well. And you forgot your soap. I mean, come on. What's
yeah,
up?
Exactly. Yeah, we're dealing with all kinds of shit every day.
Baby shit, the worst kind.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
So what's next for you guys? When did you finish the trip, by the way? I'm like thinking you just finished it a month ago, but that's obviously not possible. You've written a book, right. And, you know, so when was this, last year or the year before?
This was last year. Yeah, we started the trip in the beginning of July and ended up finishing the first day of October, I think. And so we've been traveling since then, going to Mexico, and then now we're in Dallas, Texas, and returning the end of this week, finally, for the first time in 9 months. So we're happy to get home, and we've got some projects we want to do there, some more building projects around our house, and then later this summer with Adam, actually, from the book, I'm going to be going on a trip with him across the Brooks Range in northern Alaska, extent of the Continental Divide. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the most northerly mountain range in the world, I believe, the Brooks Range.
Correct. Yep. Yeah. And one of the wildest. There's only one road that goes through it for 800 miles, only a handful of villages spread throughout. So it's one of the most intact wild ecosystems left in the world.
I interviewed a guy on the podcast, Jeff Shapiro, a few years ago. Shapiro. I don't know. Yeah, he's like a daredevil, like base jumper, wingsuit flyer, like did all that kind of stuff. And he has a falcon in his house that he takes out every day. Forget the falcon's name, but it's beautiful. It's this beautiful white cream color. Anyway, paragliding trip. Mm-hmm. On the Brooks Range, he and a friend, they would just wake, you know, get up in the morning, catch the thermals, glide 30 miles or 40 miles, you know, land, camp out for the night, do the same thing the next day. So they just flew the all the way across, you know, the length of the Brooks Range.
That's incredible.
I don't remember how long it took them, but what a great way to travel, you know.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that trip. I'll have to look it up. But I think it's called like sky camping or something. You know, you're just flying from ridgetop to ridgetop. It sounds incredible.
Yeah, yeah. Much easier on your feet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Hiking that. So you guys are going to do a trip. So what, like the Brooks Range, you got caribou migrations up there and wolves and... Are there polar bears or not yet? You just have grizzlies.
There's not polar bears in the mountains. There are polar bears on the north slope, which is basically the plains that extend out from the mountains to north into the Arctic Ocean. We're going to be flying into the town of Kaktovik, which is all the way in the northeast corner of Alaska on the Arctic Ocean, and then hiking to the mountains about, I think it's like 30 or 40 miles or so. In that stretch, it's possible that we could see polar bears. They're not, depending on what the ice is like at that time of year, it's been kind of changing each year. I hope we don't see any polar bears. That'd be nice.
Are you guys going to be armed?
Yeah. Yeah. Adam is extremely, he's competed in, I guess it's just called pistol shooting. He's competed competed shooting with handguns, so he's pretty skilled with that. We both have guns. We're going to bring one of them, and so we'll be armed. There's grizzlies out there. There's black bears in the southern portion of the range, but it's a different type of bear than, you know, I guess that are elsewhere in Alaska. There's the grizzlies and brown bears is what people call them. They're both the same species, but they're different based on their habitat. The bears in southern Alaska are brown bears. They're really big. They're not as bothered by people because there's a higher density of them due to a higher amount of food. They just have salmon, berries, right. All kinds of stuff like that. So they're able to eat for like 7 months of the year and fatten themselves up. Whereas the grizzlies in northern Alaska, the winter is longer. Since it's colder, there's less vegetation and in turn less animals, and they're a lot hungrier. So especially in the early portions of summer, the Arctic grizzlies, as some people call them, are kind of grumpy, and you don't necessarily want to come across them. Most of the time, you know, they just run the other direction, but there's always close calls and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. I was on Kodiak Island one of the years that I was up there and came across some of the Kodiak brown bears. Mm-hmm. And like you say, they're pretty chill because they're just like, right. I got salmon, I got berries, I got whatever I want. They were pretty relaxed, but very impressive. But right. Yeah, polar bear, like I would not want to come across a polar bear under any circumstances.
No, it's an ultimate predator. And especially, you know, we'll just be having like a Glock 10 millimeter handgun. So against a polar bear, you know, that stands like 10 feet tall. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's going to be like a mosquito bite for a polar bear. Like, fuck.
Right.
Well, you know what I remember about Alaska? I haven't been there since I was there two summers, 83 and 84, and I haven't been back since. But what really stands out in my memory is this feeling I had. I think I was in, I don't know if it was Kodiak, Kenai, wherever, but I was looking west and there was this, I was looking at the volcanoes across, it must have been Kenai because the volcanoes across the Cook Inlet there. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking like there are no roads in that direction all the way to Siberia. And then across, you know, 5,000 miles or whatever it is in Siberia, it's just wilderness, wilderness, wilderness. And this feeling of like being on the edge of something, you know, and I had this sensation that when I think about it, I have this sensation like the ground, it's almost like the earth was vibrating somehow. Like there was some energy in the earth that when you come back to cities and it's almost like the concrete and the weight of the roads and all the shit, like it destroys that vibration. I don't know how else to describe it. It's just this feeling of like everything's alive.
Right.
Do you still get that up there?
Yes. I felt this similarly. I'd say it depends where you are. In the cities like Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau, not as much as if you're living rurally. When I first moved there, I moved to the Arctic, living in the Brooks Range in the towns of Coldfoot and Wiseman. And, you know, Coldfoot's the bigger of the two. There's like 30 people. It's basically just a truck stop. And Wiseman's a small subsistence community has 13 people. I was the first person to move there in 11 years. So,
great. And Coldfoot. What a great
time. Yeah, exactly. So in those areas, you know, in Alaska in general, you're just so much closer to the roots of everything and to the natural environment. You know, even in Anchorage is, some people call it like Lost Anchorage or compare it to Seattle. Something like that. But, you know, there's grizzly bears walking down downtown streets and there's lynx and moose going through everywhere. You're just so much closer to the, I guess, everything else than you are elsewhere. There's not that much mediation. Part of that is, you know, the vastness of the land. If you drive, you know, between Fairbanks and Anchorage, the two of the three biggest cities in Alaska, you know, it's 6 hours and you're going to pass just a handful of towns along the way. It's not like, you know, anywhere else in the country where you do a similar drive and you're going to pass through much more development, or even just farmland. It's a wild place. And that feeling definitely still exists and you can go out there and get it if that's what you're interested in.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to get up there again before I get too old. We actually had the transmission rebuilt in the van a couple of years ago because we were planning to drive up.
Okay, cool.
And then we ended up not going. I think it was COVID hit. And
yeah.
It was like, oh, fuck it. Couldn't even get into Canada. But, you know, now that we're out of that particular crisis, maybe we'll come up next, not this summer, but maybe next summer. I'd love to just feel that again, you know, and just... Yep. And I love traveling in the van. When I went the other times, I hitchhiked, and that was very different, you know. And as you say, like with the Knowles course, it's interesting, and it feels great to have everything you need on your shoulders, you know.
Right.
In this backpack, I've got food for a week, I've got sleeping bag, I got a tent, I got, you know, whatever. That's a great feeling, but it's even better when it's a van, I got to tell you.
I believe it. I mean, you can go for longer periods of time and you have a few more luxuries. Yeah. So,
dude, I got solar panels. I got, you know, a refrigerator, freezer.
Yeah.
You know, two burner stove. Yeah. Yeah.
What more do you need?
That's luxury right there. Jack, thank you for doing the podcast. I hope some people buy your book. Where can they get it? I just have the PDF. Is it,
yeah,
is it it's a paper book or?
There's a paper book. There's paper book. There'll be a hardcover, audiobook, an ebook, all available on Amazon and all major online retailers.
Oh, that's awesome.
So yeah, wow. I could send you the link for that if you want. And yeah, it'll be available starting April 9th. So just about a week from now, we're recording on the 3rd.
Right. I'll hold this then. I won't post it until after the 9th. So people will be able to get it. So it's available on Amazon. Do you read the audiobook or how does that work?
Yep.
Great. That's an experience, isn't it? Reading
your own. It took a lot of rereads. Yeah, it was a learning experience for sure. Do you have audiobooks for yours?
I did the Civilized to Death. I did.
Okay.
I wanted to do Sex of Dawn, but they wouldn't let me.
Really?
Yeah, which bummed me out. Yeah.
So somebody else is reading it or you don't have one in general?
No, someone else reads it. A couple of actors, you know, professionals.
Right.
Basically, you know, it was my first book, and so the publisher just sort of patted me on the head and was like, no, we know what we're doing.
Right.
Thanks anyway. And it's like, come on. So they hire these actors, and they just, I think they fucked it up, but, yeah, and a lot of people have said to me, what's up with the audiobook? But it's sold a lot of copies over the years, and so I cash the checks and try to keep my mouth shut, you know?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you know, especially if it's your book and somebody else is placing their emphasis and their thoughts on it.
I'm sensitive to my own, like, tendency to be discontented with that. But the thing about Sex at Dawn is there's a lot of humor in it.
Right.
And these guys didn't get the humor.
So just serious, flatlined it throughout. Yeah,
they flatlined it, and it's like, Jesus, you're missing the fucking jokes here, people.
Right, but, right.
You know, I thought you were pros. But anyway, so that sold, you know, well enough that by the time the second book came out, I was like, yeah, I'm going to do the audio, and they were like, good, fine. That's, you know, I mean, please.
Right.
Unless you have a weird voice or you can't read or, you know, whatever, I think the author should always do it.
Right. You know? I mean, yeah, it's their book, and most people are accustomed to reading out loud or know how to read if you're writing a book anyway. So, you know, you might just have to make a few adjustments, but otherwise, yeah, good to go.
Yeah. It is kind of weird though, isn't it? Reading it out loud, the whole book. Did you notice? Like I certainly did when I was reading Civilized to Death. There were sections I was like, "Fuck, can I go back and fix this?" Like,
yeah.
Why did I use that word? That's the wrong word. Like,
I ended up editing a lot. Well, not a lot, but you know, a few words. And you read stuff, and it just sounds clunky. It's like, why are there all these commas here? What's with this clause? You know, you're trying to read a whole sentence, and you're feeling like you need an oxygen mask or something because it's just like running on forever.
Exactly.
It's a good practice in the sense that, like, if you do it before you publish it, I guess, and that you can make edits and streamline your book. But yeah, it's definitely different than writing.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Jack, thank you. And thank you to Alana for allowing you to tell this story.
Yeah, shout out to Alana for helping me with the book and letting me share with everybody, and then for all the time on the trail. It wouldn't have been possible without her.
It's going to be so cool when Din is old enough to read this.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah, I don't know. She'll get a sense of, you know, her experience on it, but then also the struggles her parents went through. So
yeah,
it'll be interesting to see what she thinks.
I mean, she probably won't remember anything specific, right? There might be some images or some sort of nebulous, who knows. But as you get into toward the end of the book, where you talk about, I think it's in the epilogue, where, you know, it's clear that it has affected her in ways, like she loves to be outside and she's always, you know, noticing things in the natural environment. And so you can see how the experience is sort of folded into the structure of her personality, even if she doesn't remember anything. So I just think it'll be so fascinating for her to read this and sort of look in the mirror and be like, wait a minute, okay, I'm seeing myself a little differently now, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, who knows, you know, if all that stuff, you know, continues to happen and her being outside and however it shaped her development, she can perhaps get a better understanding from being able to read that, like you mentioned. So yeah, I think it'll be neat for her to look back on and have this as a way to remember the trip, even if she's not able to have any actual memories herself.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. You carry the baby. I'll carry the tent. Jack McClure is the author. You can find it on Amazon. I think it's got 4.9 stars at this point. Online, all sorts of places. I don't know if your local bookstore will have it, but it's certainly on Amazon. And the song again was, what was it? Find My Way, A Way Back Home. And the band is Give Me Motion. So if you enjoyed that, please check out Give Me Motion on Spotify and wherever you find your tunes. All right, I'm going to play you out with the wonderful Carcy Blanton, Smoke Alarm, reminding you that as much as it feels like this goes on forever, that's only because the ones it's already ended for aren't here to tell us that it ends. So everyone around us is still alive. Kind of weird, huh? Talk about confirmation bias. Anyway, remember, you're going to die one day. Love y'all.
He said, baby, what's a big deal? Feel what you want to feel. Say what you want to say. You're gonna die one day. For example, I could kiss you just because I want to. What's the difference if you turn away? I'm gonna die one day. Why do you waste your time thinking about your reputation? Trying to meet an expectation, wondering what they're gonna say. Headstone. I don't want to give the end away, but we're gonna die one day. Your body is an animal, doesn't ask for much. A little music and a soft touch. Why don't you let it out to play? Your heart is in a birdcage, singing in your chest. Wanna shut it up but give it a rest. You're gonna die one day. Why do we waste our time thinking about a reputation? Running from a confrontation, wondering what we ought to say. When everyone we've ever known is headed for a headstone. It's a big deal if you wanna be free. say what you wanna feel. Spend the night with me. I'm gonna take you up in my arms. And if we must go down, we'll go singing to the smoke alarms. We'll dance into the ground.